everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. The first order of business is we recessed the last council meeting so that we could take up some bids for the parking ramp. So I will call the meeting to order for the recessed council meeting. We can dispense with the opening items and move directly to reports and recommendations.
Note the presence of a quorum.
And I will note that we do have a presence of a quorum. Only Councilmember Bilderback is missing at the moment. So, item E1 is the award of bids for city parking ramp number 6. We have a number of items in our packet. Mr. Freeze, did you want to give us an update?
Well, there are two items on your agenda today, one dealing with the award of bids and the other dealing with entering into a contract for the construction manager for the project. And one kind of goes hand in hand with the other from the perspective that this is the first project that I'm aware of that the city has bid using a construction manager as advisor format. We typically do design, bid, build, low bid. All the work is combined into one bid document. So as you will notice in for E1, there are 15 different bid packages that were advertised and we received quotations on. And I would ask that, and this was set up this way in the RCA, so that in essence you need to approve each one of those. I'll leave it to the city attorney to decide if you can do it in block or if you need to identify 3A, 3B, 4A, 4A.
What are your RCA set up?
Basically just approve them in block.
I think they're correct.
Okay. So that sounds like you can do it in block. I really wanted Terry to have to read that, but no. So there are three things, four things actually we're asking you to consider today. At the time of receipt of bids, there were three bids that were deemed to be non-responsive for failure to include the required attachments, and those were not read, and they're listed for contract 7A, 22A, and 31A. There was one bid that was read and later found to be non-responsive for its failure to include attachment J. That was the bid for 21A. And then there are the bids and the bid sheets that were provided for the 15 contracts. If you recall, over the past year and a half or so, as we've talked about this project, we've talked about the possibility of adding residential housing on top of a portion of the parking garage. And we asked your permission to bid that extra work, that reinforcing of the footings and foundations and columns and beams associated with providing that future opportunity as an additive alternate. That is listed in the RCA as item number 4. The bids for that would total it's a combination of bid 3A and 31A. Those are the two components that were involved in that additional work, and it totals about $512,000. Our estimate when we first approached you with this was about $750,000, but it was really a very early estimate in the process, and so now we've got a hard number for you to look at and make that decision. So those are the four items related to the award of bids that we'd like to request the council to take action on.
Mr. Hickey?
I had a question on that bid alternate. As I recall the discussion at the time, we said, you know, we go forward and get a price on it, but then there'd be some decision point. I mean, how likely is it that we're going to actually execute this? Is there really developer interest? Trying to determine a probability or making this decision if it's money well spent or if there's not a lot of interest in it.
Everyone, I talked to probably four different developers, each of them thought initially it was a good idea. Subsequently, one of them said they didn't, so they changed their mind. But out of the three who were favorable, two thought it should be residential, one thought it actually should be office. So there was some concern about the fact that the design as it was originally conceived by the architect, it was the fact that it was a single load hallway.
Right.
And that didn't necessarily make it as cost effective. The footprint is fairly narrow. It's 60 foot wide. So there was some concern in that regard. We did not actively market the property because that's what you would be considering would be the possible sale of the air rights to allow the construction of a private facility on top of a publicly owned parking garage. But we did not actively market it. We just basically had talked to a lot of the people that you've seen over the last year and a half or so come before you with housing projects. Talked to Mr. Stenzel, Mr. Henderson with HGA, and a couple others.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Wojcik?
I actually appreciate the question. I'm just checking real quick. So we'd be basically a push as long as we could sell the air rights at $500,000 then?
Yes.
Boy, that's that would, the break even point would be, and this is again going residential offices, obviously, a better return for the city. That's $5,000 per unit, assuming 100 units. I think it goes well beyond that in terms of
its gain.
That's a land cost of $5,000 a unit for building apartments in downtown Rochester. I mean, we'll never know for certain, but boy, that's a folks are paying 10 times that right now. So,
well, I think my opinion would be at least it preserves our options for the future. We're not obligated to do anything. But clearly, if we don't spend the money up front, you're never going to do it after the fact. So in the grand scheme of things of a $23.5-24 million project, that $500,000 seems to be a good investment in my mind. Anyone else?
I agree. 2.1% on the total project cost, so could really be has the potential to either be used as apartment. I like the idea of, is there commercial space up there? Maybe it's something the city retains. I mean, it could be a valuable opportunity for us to expand some of our services there too, if it turns out we need it for future development. So I think it's, we probably want to acquire land that inexpensively downtown. So it could be a really good opportunity.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
I got one.
Mr. Ruskin.
Mr. Freeze, this is kind of a unique package of bids and that. You alluded to it earlier. Can you give us bring everybody up to speed a little bit on how we got to this process and what our goals are in going this route?
That kind of gets into E2. If you'd like to talk about it now, I'm sure we can.
Well, so that's fine. If you want to, it probably would make some sense if we're going to get to E2.
We looked at alternatives over the years for the construction of public projects. We again looked at the design bid build approach. We switched to best value for a number of our public buildings several years ago. I think overall had reasonable success with that. Some projects were better than others. But the one thing that kind of repeated itself over and over is we were spending a lot of money on administrative costs associated with inspection and contract oversight. So we talked about alternatives, and it came to our attention that construction manager as advisor was a process that was used a lot by school districts for the construction of public school buildings, and that it would possibly be an alternative that we should give some consideration to. I think how all this came together was the fact that Cross Anderson, who we're recommending to be our construction manager as advisor, is also working on the adjoining Hilton Hotel project. And the amount of cooperation, collaboration, and coordination that is necessary in building these two projects simultaneously is, I think, what really tipped us in the direction that this made a lot of sense for us to proceed in this direction. By hiring Cross Anderson, then we basically eliminated one of our potential bidders to do the work, as the type of work that Cross Anderson would do. But it also put us in a situation that allowed us to have somebody very experienced and, again, very connected and involved in the adjacent project. And since our commitment to the Titan Development Group for the Hilton project was the fact that this ramp would be done
project?
Could this be the most complex public works project we've ever done in downtown Rochester?
I don't know. No, seriously. This format is new for us, so...
But the project itself, it seems to be, there's just a ton of moving pieces.
Yeah, and I think it's actually quite a good learning experience for everyone involved. We're getting to the point that this is big time now. I mean, the fact that we've got all of this construction we're going in, and it's affecting how traffic moves and everything else. Big cities deal with this stuff all the time, and you know, we haven't had to deal with it. We're learning as we go along. Again, to have a situation such as Cross Anderson that can help us is very, very beneficial. But I would say, in all seriousness, the answer to your questions, yes, this is probably the most, other than probably the flood control, which I wasn't here for, but that was quite complex too.
Do you know, are we going to be able to use the existing sky crane for this project, or will we need a separate crane?
We will have a separate crane. That's in fact part of what the services that Cross Anderson provides, is providing those. I believe the cost for those is listed here in one of the documents. It's about $400,000.
Is that a sky crane, or is that going to be a more traditional lift?
It'll be a tower crane.
It will be a tower crane. Leading question a little bit here. My inclination, assuming we go with the options, would be to put out a request for proposals for developing the space on top of the ramp. Is that crane capable of supporting a potential project there?
It would be. It's not, at this point, spec to go that tall, but it could be changed.
It would be a moderate change order to just add some more structure to the tower then, or...
Depending
on the size and height.
You know, realistically, we're going from, what, 6 stories to maybe 10 or something if we did that, or...
You'd be adding 10 more stories.
10 more stories.
Yeah.
Okay.
It could be jacked from the current height that it's planned for now to accommodate that.
So, I mean, it's $400,000 for the existing train, and I don't expect you to have exact, but ballpark, what are we talking about for, you know, to jack it up if we wanted to do that?
The jacking process is about... ballpark is maybe $40,000 for them to come do.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. So I probably shouldn't say about $40,000 in public, but you know, relative to the whole cost. That's my concern, is if we do go forward, I would just assume do a request for proposals and, you know, give them what we're doing and let them fit it in.
Okay.
So that answers my crane question.
Again, it would make it a lot more attractive to the developer if they could utilize the tower crane that was already in.
Yes, I may have had a developer to tell me that.
I know there's a question that Councilmember Bildebeck wanted to bring up, and I know it's a detail, but I know we're looking at pedestrian safety among all of our public ramps and making sure that they're appropriately configured. Is that something that will be part and parcel of this project?
Yes, we actually provided him a response this morning on some of his concerns at some of the other parking garages, and we'll be incorporating those. Addressing his concerns in the design of this.
Okay, thank you.
And his concerns were basically at the exiting.
Right, right.
Warning vehicles, as they, pedestrians in particular, as they exit the vehicle, is leaving the ramp.
Okay. Mr. Campion, you had something?
The logistics of potentially putting out a request for proposal, or, you know, has staff already invested time into planning for this, or what are the logistics look like? Because I can understand why people would want to get moving, why some of the machinery is in place versus having to bring that all and do a staging process again.
We've looked at it from the perspective that we shared with you, and I have copies here today of some of the different floor plans. Again, I've had oral conversations with 4 different developers. That's the extent of
our okay. So if there is a more, I mean, it appears that there could be benefit here. Is there, it'd be a more formal process here to kick that off and to get going?
Definitely.
Staff time is available to do that?
If that was the direction of the council, I'd be available.
Isn't that nice? All right. I believe so. Mr. Atkins, do we need 4 separate motions, or there's 4 requested council item action items?
As was going to move approval of the four different points.
You can do it in block.
Okay. The four Second. Different points on page three of the packet. If you're good with that.
Second.
All right. Motion by Mr. Roscoe, second by Mr. Wojcik. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries 6-0. And Mr. Goldback is not here. Moving on to item E2, which is the construction manager of advisor contract. Freeze.
Well, we kind of briefly touched on this. This is a new way up, a new business for us. We're really excited about the opportunity it presents for us. There's a lot more work that's gone in the upfront. I don't want to oversimplify this, but all of this work would have been done by the general contractor. And what we've done, and you would have paid a markup on every one of the subs bids. The general marks all of the subs up, you know, 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, some more than others maybe. Somebody would have had to pay for a tower crane. Somebody would have had to pay for toilets, portable toilets. So all of these costs are things that would have been included in documents, other documents that were bid as part of a more traditional bid. That bid would have estimated, as all bids do, the developer or the contractor's cost. The way a lot of these are set up is that you're going to just pay actual. So there won't be an estimate of how many portable toilets are needed. Okay? And if the contractor overestimated, you pay those regardless. This will be if there's 10 that are needed, 10 will be provided. So from an accounting perspective, a cost accounting perspective, tracking the real costs associated with managing and administering these contracts, this sets itself up very well to do that. But like I say, it's just a different way of doing business for us. I believe it's costing us less money to go this way. I guess the proof will be when we're all done to see what the final amount is. But right now, based on what you have in front of you, this is less than what a traditional approach would cost us to provide this same level of service.
All right. Questions, comments? Ms. Johnson.
Are there other cities who have done this? I mean, we're not reinventing the wheel here, are we? I mean, obviously for Rochester a little bit, but did you kind of play this or follow the lead from another city?
Actually, we looked at the examples that we looked at more closely were what school districts are doing.
School districts? Okay. And those school districts here in Rochester? Or
I believe the
this Rochester.
School district is okay. MS, for example.
Okay, so this hasn't necessarily, that you're aware of, hasn't been done on a city level? Or
oh, yes.
It has? Yeah. Okay, thank you.
It's provided for, you know, in the statute. It's just something that we have not used before.
Okay, perfect. That's perfect to know. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Otherwise, I'd entertain a motion.
Move approval.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Campion, second by Mr. Wojcik. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries.
If I could just share with you one other thing. I apologize, I know you've got a busy agenda today. But it would have been the third item, or third page in your E1 packet. It was a breakdown of the bids, but the far right column, we're very happy to see the amount of minority and women business enterprise participation. If you recall, Gary and I have talked to you in the past about the fact that the DNC legislation has certain goals for not only participation but dollar value in these contracts, and the fact that we were almost at 10% on our very first public project, we were very, very happy to see that.
The goal of your plan is 4, so you're more than double the goal.
It's not easy. That's outstanding.
All right. Anything else, Mr. Wojcik?
Well, and we don't need to do it today, but I would like to not lose sight of the opportunity to do a request for proposal for that space on top of the garage. At this point, it's sunk cost for us. So, I would maybe ask for just maybe some direction to staff to bring that back to us sometime here in the second quarter, so we can have a request for proposal and decisions made in a timeline that allows them to plan for ongoing construction on the site as opposed to tearing everything down and starting over.
Okay.
Is that fair?
That makes sense.
Second quarters?
All right.
Cool with everyone? Okay.
All right, Mr. Atkins.
Oh, did you have something
to add? I was going to move to suspend the rules to allow a second reading of changes to the Ethical Practices Board ordinance.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion by Mr. Wojcik, second by Mr. Campion to suspend the rules. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries.
Mr. President, may we go to item H, resolutions and ordinances?
All right.
For second reading and final passage, an ordinance creating and enacting Subdivision 7 of Section 13.10 and amending Subdivision 1 and Clause B of Subdivision 3 of Section 13.10 of the Rochester Code of Ordinances relating to temporary members and composition of the Ethical Practices Board.
Move adoption.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Campion for adoption, second by Mr. Wojcik. Any discussion?
I would just say, you know, I apologize for throwing you guys for a loop last week, but I just wasn't ready and wanted to bounce it off some people, so I was happy with the responses I got. I think these are good changes, so happy to move it along.
All right, anyone else? Call the question. All in favor then, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. Mr. Atkins.
At last week's meeting, I gave first reading to an ordinance redesignating Spruce Meadows Lane Southeast to Spruce Meadows Drive Southeast. I didn't catch the fact that planning had asked for the rules to be suspended and that ordinance be given its second reading. Better late than never. With that motion, I would ask that you suspend the rules to allow that ordinance to take effect.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Wojcik, second by Mr. Campion to suspend the rules. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carried.
For second reading and final passage, an ordinance amending and reenacting Section 75.01 of the Rochester Code of Ordinances relating to the designation of Spruce Meadows Lane Southeast to Spruce Meadows Drive Southeast.
Move adoption.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Campion, second by Ms. Johnson. Any discussion?
I feel okay winging this one.
All right. All in favor then, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries.
That's all I have.
All right. Then I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
Motion by Mr. Ruska, second by Mr. Campion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. So the city councilman meeting is now adjourned, and we'll commence with the remainder of our committee of the whole meeting, beginning with item 2, which is the municipal broadband update. Mark or staff, or who's going to step us through this?
Yeah.
All right.
At the July 25th committee of the whole meeting, we came away with three questions from the council. First was to come back with a cost estimate for a study determining the local interest in service. The second point was questions around what different cities have done in this respect, and to come back with some information for you on that. And the third was around some legal and compliance limitations or questions that maybe they need to consider. So in light of that, I'm kind of addressing mainly 1 and 2. I think the legal questions will come a little bit later. There is a little bit within the scope of work of the proposal that I have written before. So go to the next page there. What I have done is asked an engineering firm, Burton McDonald, essentially a statement of work broken down into two phases. First phase really being around the market analysis piece there, where they would come in and survey the council and some staff on what the desired outcomes are, conduct that survey essentially in the community, look at some of the regional competitors' analysis work there, look at market trends of similar cities, some market profitability analysis, and then come back to the council with their report to answer questions and then get direction at that point if you want them to go any further into phase 2. Phase 2 is if there was an affirmative to move phase two is really about kind of putting together a business plan, looking at different business scenarios, and within that, the up to four, I just put in there some examples of, you know, people who's an owner operator or a public-private partnership or a, you know, some kind of an incentive program. There's multiple ways to, you know, arrive at the outcomes that the council may desire. Then also doing financial analysis there, and then a risk assessment, both identifying, you know, key risk factors and sensitivity analysis through a business plan or financial projection around that. Then, again, at the end of phase two, we come back to the council looking for your input to how to proceed from that point there. Any questions about the kind of the statement where we're facing pieces of that? So then we can go to the next one here. The pricing that I've been quoted on that is for phase one, $35,000, phase two, $12,000. So as I said, this is kind of a bringing the information back on the request. The original request was in relation to the business plan that Alistair Lucent had presented to the council. And we did a preliminary analysis, and then you had a number of questions coming out of that. We wanted to ask some more questions and get some more information. Any questions from the council staff?
Questions, comments? Mr. Campion.
Did they give any guidance about what the timeline would be for?
I think a lot of that we could give them the timeline as to what, you know, our expectations would be. I think, you know, if we were to sign a contract,
sure,
we would act on that.
Mr.
Roger. So I'm curious what this includes. Actually, the prices I'm seeing there were significantly less than I thought. Does this include the actual market study here in Rochester?
Yes, phase one would actually be doing a market study.
What exactly does that include? Because when I hear market study, my thought is, you know, that's where you're analyzing the scenarios of, okay, if we do this, competition does this, how do people respond?
I think that's more in the sensitivity analysis piece of that. There's a second piece.
Oh, but that's still included in these numbers?
Yes, it was.
Oh, okay. No, that's, okay. Appreciate
it. I was surprised by the numbers, too. I was expecting.
Could you tell me a little bit more about this, the company, Burns & McDonnell?
Burns & McDonnell is a fairly large engineering firm, primarily. They work a lot in the utility space, but they do work in the cable and internet space as well. Looking at their, I had them send me some experience with the things that they've done. A lot of their market analysis work has been more in the utility industries, rather than in specifically internet cable, but they do have an internet cable group as well that does work on that.
Okay. Other questions, comments?
And I had actually asked a similar question, just to make sure that Burns and Mac, this was in their wheelhouse, and staff got back to me that they felt this was comfortable, but they were going to double check, so.
Mr. Ruskin.
I guess I'm confused a little bit. Is RPU going to drive this in paper?
Actually, I need to clarify that point as well. Within our charter, RPU is actually, we're not chartered to actually do this kind of internet or cable type of stuff, so we would have to get direction through our board and through the council, basically, some form of ordinance expanding the scope. Otherwise, it needs to be done through the city.
Okay, my follow-up question would be then, is the RPU board in support of this kind of expenditure if we were to authorize that from there?
Actually, they wouldn't be any of these funds in the RPU budget. This would be city funds. This would
But are they in support of this effort?
They were in support of the RPU board approved me getting the information and bringing it back to the council, but they basically said that was kind of a limit of their, they felt like they were kind of stretching already a little bit on their charter and really didn't want to go much beyond that unless given further direction.
Anyone else? And where would the funding come from?
Contingency account.
So,
go ahead.
So the RPU board is okay with the city spending money on this? But they don't want to spend it on their own?
And then it's a council request. I'm kind of wearing the city council hat today, and that I'm responding to the request from the council for this information. So it isn't really an RPU. You know, it's not within our charter at present.
Mr. Campion?
I'm going to read between the lines. They felt at the edge of their jurisdictional ability to make recommendations about the actual engagement of this. They were happy with having you do it at our request, is kind of what I'm hearing.
Basically, without having to expend, you know, RPU funds, you know, regulated funds, they're okay with us doing the inquiry to get the information.
Mr. Wood. Oh, I'm sorry.
Who are you with again?
I'm with Rochester Public Utilities.
You are, okay. Because it sounds like you're tied up.
There's a white hat.
All right, trying to remember.
Yeah, and I can speak a little bit on that because it's not my intention to have staff dancing on eggshells on that one. But in reality, right, the budget RPU has for 2017 is set up to fund an electric utility and a water utility. And that's why they'd be looking for the city contingency funds to ultimately fund what is a potentially a third utility, but it doesn't fall on the other utilities. That said, and I can't speak for all of the board members, but I think there's an understanding that there are potential utility-related benefits to this. So I don't think anyone would want to squash it, but they're clearly looking to the city council for direction. And I'm not overstepping my boundaries on the RPU board, just saying that we're pushing it to the city council for that decision.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I'm still trying to understand. So let's say we do the study and it comes back, yeah, this is a great idea. I mean, we're going to expand RPU's mission to do this, or Richard's going to take over and form a department of internet and cable? I mean, what's it going to look like?
And under the charter, the council has the authority to add utilities to Rochester Public Utilities. Mm-hmm. So that is an option. Or you could do it outside of RPU and create your own city department or a division within a city department. So those options are both available to you, but they don't need to be decided right now.
Okay, Mr. Wilger?
And what I would say, I'm, you know, a lot of what you're talking about is maybe some of the phase two stuff that they're going to get us some different options. I'm obviously very much in love with what Longmont, Colorado has done, but that said, any route that would address the concerns that I see with broadband and that we have, you know, a decided lack of competition in most areas. Our tech is lacking and our pricing is not particularly competitive. That can be done through a public-private partnership where we own a little bit of infrastructure and a partner comes in to operate it as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be owned and operated, and I think that part of that is what is the best fit for Rochester. So,
Mr. Martinson?
I just wanted to comment that the Department of Economic Development of the state of Minnesota, they would like to come down and talk to you at some point, too, because they've done a number of models where they've assisted communities to do an RFP, basically build a private partnership kind of thing, and they just did one with the city of Minneapolis for internet or something like that. I can't remember who it was that actually got the bid. But so a private company is basically going to do it with some in terms of the city provided, as opposed to the city getting in and trying to create a whole new company and hire a whole new set of employees and run a whole new business like that. But again, it's something we are thinking about, want to look at when they come back with the feasibility report and then have some of these other people talk to you about some of these other options. But.
Okay. Mr. Campion, you had a question?
Whoever's driving the presentation, can we go back to the phase one list? Or? Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I saw the list because, I mean, it looks like we do have a decision point after this first point to decide and wanted to make sure we have all the information that would probably address some of what you're bringing up about the market and what it will cost.
Mr. Ruskin?
Why wasn't this in the packet? I mean, it's three slides. And, you know, I guess I'm kind of looking at this. I didn't know we were going to have a request for funds today on this, and I'm kind of frustrated that, you know, that someone as close to the works closely as with the city as RPU does can't get us these three slides so we can kind of know what's going on. We've got a listing that says RPU update on, you know, it's an update, and this is now we got a request in here for funds, and I guess I was expecting when this was kicked back to this to an oversight or a group to research this a little bit, that they were going to come back with a yes, we should pursue this, or no, we shouldn't, and instead of now we've got another bill on our hands. So I guess I'm a little disappointed in that.
Mr. Campion.
Maybe point of order for today, you're informing us, and then we will have probably a request for council action at the meeting on whether or not to pay for this. Is that the appropriate way?
That would be the appropriate way to proceed.
Perfect. So, I mean, I feel informed. I agree. There's oftentimes we receive presentations in here where I got to tell you, when we're put in a hot seat to consume stuff, you know, spend $30 to $23 million in a meeting, it's kind of nice to get ahead of time. But I appreciate it. At least we're going to have it. Now we can chew it over until we have to make a vote at the council meeting.
I would just once again back RPU staff a little bit. There has been some direction throughout this process that they were to share information with the council all at the same time in a setting like this. That's what they're doing. We're not handing out any money today, but this can lead to a vote on handing out money.
Mr. Ruskin.
I guess I was looking to see if this is feasible and if it's something that we think we should be doing versus we've just kind of killed about a year now and we're kind of right back to where we were. I guess I don't see that there's, if I saw that the RPU board and people were saying this is a good idea, we should pursue it, instead they're just saying we need more money to look at it. So I guess I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus here. I just guess I was expecting a little bit more clear direction when it came back to us.
I'm going to do a little rehash. I wrote down the history of this a little bit because I disagree with the implication of what we were looking to get for, because we actually gave very explicit direction to what we were going to get at this presentation, and this hits the nail on the head. You know, this came about because a lot of us, and if we talk to our citizens and businesses, there's a concern out there. People want some action. We had a business case presented by Alcatel-Lucent, which showed a clearly viable business plan. Obviously, we wanted to get a second opinion on that, so we hired an independent consultant to vet that plan. They found some things that change, but largely they said, once again, yes, this is a very good financial plan for a potential financial benefit for the city of Rochester. After that, the key piece that you need to figure out is, okay, so you have assumptions in there that you're going to have 35% uptake or something like that. You actually need to do a market study to verify that these numbers are correct. And the market study is where you start to expend some more significant dollars, which is, you know, what you see here. And they're bringing us back now a opportunity to get some of these very specific questions answered. Because if all of the assumptions are correct in the business case that's already been independently vetted, this is a home run for us. The market study helps to test those variables, the sensitivity, and see how it's done. So I do think the request to RPU is to specifically bring this information back, what would it cost, and allow us to make that decision. And I think that's been fulfilled.
Other comments? Campion.
So the other thing I'm hearing that it sounds like we can expand the scope of RPU to encompass this activity. Is that true or false?
That's an option available to you? Yes.
Okay. So if it is a matter of feeling limited by jurisdiction or by kind of what the charter has enabled you to do, then perhaps that's another thing we should look at is how do we, if we want to, and how would we go about enabling kind of the more... I'm looking for the correct word, but enabling you guys to basically do this within and fall within your charter kind of designation. Is that, I'm kind of getting that feedback? Is that
well, you know, we obviously have a charter, so we have a start here, NCF, electric utility,
right.
Water utility.
And it is.
Revenue from those are for those purposes and not for other purposes.
Right.
So if we did something like this, we'd still need a revenue source.
Sure.
So.
Okay. One of the reasons that I asked about the company is we got off to a bad start in my mind on this because we had the Alcatel presentation, and I personally made a request for additional information from the people presenting. I didn't hear a peep, not a word. So I was a little disappointed that they would come before us and make a pitch and then not even respond to questions. So all I'm saying is we got off to a little bit of a rough start, so I want to make sure that if we're going to engage this company, that they're truly reputable and
This isn't the same group as Alcatel-Lucent. Alcatel-Lucent was a separate, you know, entity, and in the defense of the guy that didn't get back to you, he ended up having medical issues in November, December of last year, and was really, I couldn't get hold of him either. So he was kind of off the grid for a little while.
Mr. Atkins?
In my 26 years here, and as an attorney for RPU, I can tell you Burns and McDonald has a very long established relationship with utility, and they've performed very well.
All right, any other questions or comments? So we will have a chance to bring this forward for official action to address the funding request, correct? All right.
Are we going to do that at the next meeting then?
Certainly can.
Seem legitimate to me.
Okay.
Perfect, thank you.
Thank you.
And if you could we get these slides?
So yes. We'll
have them. All right, thank you. All right, moving on. Herbicide use policy. Mr. Freeze, or who's going to step us through this one?
Well, it's spring, as evidenced by this past weekend, and we wanted to bring back to you, an official policy statement that applies to public works and our use of herbicides. There were some concerns raised last spring. That emanated a lot, I think, from a picture that appeared in the newspaper of our contractor and their application method. We've taken the time to write up a policy that talks about not only the policy itself, but our practices, the permitted products, notification and warning signs, and again, how we're going to communicate this information to the public through our website, through signs that are posted and other things like that. So, again, just wanted to get back to you before the contract period started for our vendor to begin. We have indicated to our vendor that we want them to do all of the herbicide application using backpacks and walking and not driving down the street using vehicles and applicators sitting in the back of tailgates. So, in doing so, we found that that actually obviously is a much better approach, less use of chemicals, and costs us just a little bit more. But so all we're looking for, what we are looking for today is basically just an acknowledgement by the council. You don't need to vote on it, but is this something that seems reasonable to you, or would you like to see us more information?
One comment as I read through the proposal, I like the idea that we're certainly going to try to be proactive in informing the public of when we're going to be applying herbicides. I really like the fact that we try non-chemical uses first, whether it be mowing or whatever else. And then I also like the fact that individuals can subscribe to being notified in cases when herbicides are applied.
Sorry.
We'll just pretend. Right.
in fairness, I felt like Sandra was back.
Oh my gosh!
So those are just some of my comments, Mr. Campion.
I don't need to approve it. I think it's a good idea. I think we should just tell them to go forward, post it, and execute it. I think it's falls firmly within the oversight responsibility of the head of public works.
Mr. Ruska, then Ms. Johnson.
I would agree. This is clear and concise, and it does addresses all the issues that we've had in the past, and I think it's very well done, so completely supportive of it.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson?
Is there a map of where you spray, like when you're going to spray, so people know where to avoid, or parks that don't use herbicides?
Well, the Parks Department has their own policy.
Okay, this is just on the...
Right.
Okay.
This is just the public right-of-way.
Perfect.
So...
You're good then.
Well, we do notify certain areas, but we don't have a map that shows specifically we're going to do this on Tuesday and that on Thursday.
Okay, or like we're going to be in this neighborhood, this area, this week.
To the extent that we can.
Okay.
Because, again, the contractor is going to do as much work as they can on a good day, and on a bad weather day, they obviously aren't working. So.
Right. Okay.
Storja?
So I think it's important that we have this policy because we're gonna keep getting those phone calls or notes with people who complain, and I think it's not fair to staff that we turn around and put it on them, and now staff can say, this is the policy you approved. Let us know how you want to change it. And, now it's firmly on us once we approve a policy. I put this out for comments, and the only comment that I got, and I think it's kind of a good idea, but I don't know how much work it would be, is somebody suggested that we should put a map out of the portion of the city that drains into our watersheds untreated. And there's a lot of downtown core areas that do that, other areas that go to stormwater ponds. And I don't know with GIS how hard it would be to put together a map like that. But it does, there's particular sensitivity when you're in areas that drain directly into the rivers. And that was the only feedback I got. I didn't have any strong objections from anyone else.
Posting the policy will draw the strong objections out, so I would just assume get the policy posted, and then if people have feedback, you know, the great thing about it being in a Word document is that we can work on it and change it as necessary. But I completely agree with Councilman Voreska. This is great work. We're ready to move forward on this and get it off the council radar.
I would agree. The season is upon us, so we might as well get it out there, and there's nothing that says we can't tweak it going forward.
Thank you,
Mr. Mayor.
A question maybe for Park Department. For soccer fields and things like that, are we doing anything different?
We have right now, we've got a full policy also for OSAD application, pesticide application. We do limit, we've got tolerance thresholds that we set for sports fields, for landscape areas, for these different areas, as what we'll tolerate. I can sure share that with you.
Okay.
We still fertilize, oversee, do some mechanical removals, and we still use some chemical applications, but we put a dent over the last few years by quite a bit. We also, by the way, did implement our pesticide-free park program last year, and we doubled the number of parks to 2 per ward this year.
Okay, thank you.
Can we cross-reference those policies? Because that's another thing, is the same, Councilmember Johnson, with that, the same people come to me, they want the public works and the parks. Right. Can we just have a link to each other's policies across departments here, so someone comes in, they can find both of them? I think that's a simple thing to do to make it look cohesive.
I think that makes sense, because the public won't really distinguish whether it's a park or a ditch or whatever.
Everything looks the same.
All right. Anything else on this one?
Thank you.
All right,
thank
then. Thank you,
Richard.
We will move on to our annual police department review. Chief Peterson, or who's going to step us through this?
We gave you an update last year. Kind of hit the highlights. We intend to do the same this year, more of an update. Apologize when you give these slides, but we're not asking for money.
Yeah, you guys are pretty much free.
Yeah. Joe Conkert was our prime analyst. We'll go through these, and we'll have plenty of time for questions or any other information you'd like.
All right. Good afternoon. I'm Joe Conkert. I'm the crime analyst at RPD. And so we've got some update slides that provide some kind of background on our recent and historical trends. Overall, what we've seen is pretty similar to what we presented last year. We've had our demand and our overall incident numbers are just our pure call for service demand. I've kind of found a lower equilibrium over the past 4 to 5 years, which is a good thing, as opposed to the last 15 years. So overall, generally, we do see kind of a subtrend for that, though, in that while we have a little bit of a decline in overall numbers, the types of calls that we're being called to, the nature of those calls, and certainly the result, it's really hard to do causality, but we do see a correlation between higher numbers of officers being required per incident. So that's something that we're paying attention to, and I think that's really the takeaway here, is that we're having a little bit less calls for service, but again, we're having more serious situations that we're dealing with more routinely. And that results in a little bit less proactive capability. We've had a couple officers since last year, which is great, and that will help to pad that a little bit. But again, that's sort of that incident mix is probably what we're most focused on right now. And really, that lack of pro- sub-trends is that it reduces our ability to sort of deal with some of these point source problem generators that are really the hallmark of intelligence led policing, which is our guiding philosophy, which says there's really a small number of people, places, and inefficiencies within our department and within the judicial system that create the majority of our problems. And if we can sort of polish those burrs off a little bit, we can really do some great things. And we did recently at sort of a staff retreat last fall for some training on this management implementation. And I believe what we took away from that was we learned from some instructors from down in Tampa Bay, and they had seen similar reductions in their call for service numbers, their raw numbers. So I think this is consistent with some of the approaches they took and some of the initial results they've had. We're sort of seeing some similar results from what they saw, which is good to see.
Can you define nuisance-related incident?
Yeah, so those would be noise calls for service, loud parties, dogs, theft, shoplift, for example, in a criminal sense. Just those incidents that are relatively low, they're not going to generate a report, they're not going to generate but they reduce the, our concept is social harm. We look at how do incidents impact the larger community, and that's sort of how we view things as those incidents that are tied to more social harm, or some instances have relatively low social harm, others have higher.
Thanks.
And so, again, we're trying to focus on those things and take our limited resources and give you the best value in a way that the community wants. So that's what we've seen so far. This slide will give you an overview of the year 2000, way on the left, and then these are our monthly incident counts all the way through the end of 2016. You can see we did, and this is very similar to what we learned in our sort of some training with the over the fall, is that when you start to focus, you build that proactive capacity, which we did, Chief Pearson did over the last 10 years, you start to reduce some of your frequent generators of your police incidents. And so I think that's what we're seeing so far. We had an uptick in 2015, but I think we've sort of hit an equilibrium now.
Do you correlate that with population, for example, so you can get an incident per capita, that sort of thing?
I don't have an incident per capita right on this slide. We do have our violent crimes per capita, but no, these are raw numbers right here.
Mr. Campion?
This is all incidents, not just...
They're all police incidents that the police department had an officer respond to.
Okay.
So we noticed an issue with some of our data last year where system, it was anytime the sheriff's office were on the same record system, was making a sheriff's only for example a traffic stop within the city, and no city officers responded. We were actually counting some of those, so we're delving into our data quite a bit too as we through this philosophy.
I think this goes to one of the comments the chief has mentioned before, that just eyeballing it looks like the trend is downward sloping, and I know our population is up, so you would tend to think our incident per capita is going down.
That is, yes, correct, and that is the intent.
Mr. Nolte.
So I think the previous report said 2015 was the safest overall year in the modern history of the city. How did 2016 compare?
Overall, I guess it's a mixed bag. Part one crimes, those are the ones that the FBI classifies as serious crimes. That includes major murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, theft, auto theft, and arson. Those are the eight crimes. I will give you a caveat. Theft is not necessarily what we would consider a serious crime. The theft of any amount is not a serious crime. But with that caveat, those numbers continue to go down. They were down slightly, down 1%. If you figured in the population increase, it was down closer to 2%. The part two crimes, less serious offenses, were up. That would be about 3%. So overall, we're seeing a slight increase. Largely, when we look at those increases, particularly in the part two offenses, we're looking at increases in misdemeanor assaults. We're seeing an increase in drug abuse violations, and we're also seeing increases in what's classified as other offenses, but those things that Joe has articulated, some of the more minor offenses. So I don't think that those are probably surprises to anybody. What Joe also mentioned, though, is our proactive response as more time is involved in this reactive response and more officers are involved. The proactive response is what necessarily suffers. So we see things like arrests for driving under the influence have decreased. In this case, I think it's a good example, we had 189 arrests for DUI in 2016, where in 2015 that was 242. Now, unfortunately, the incidence of drunk driving hasn't necessarily decreased by that percentage, but the amount of time available for free or a proactive patrol there. So those kind of things that are officer initiated, and Joe will get more into that some future slides, but those tend to decrease as more time is wrapped up in a response or primary response to reactive type of incidents, and as Joe said, more officers being involved in those incidents.
This is basically the same data, just aggregated at the annual basis, so you can kind of confirm those sort of trends that I've been talking about in the last time. Again, these are incidents which are just sort of our natural demand. They aren't necessarily the measures of crime.
So probably significant off of the numbers. You will see that the crime reporting, the actual number of the crimes that officers attend to, comprise about 10% of the calls that officers are dispatched to. And use an example, a site call, a critical intervention type of call, is not a crime. And those type of calls that don't constitute a crime but require a police response, everything from medical to site calls to traffic accidents. Crime in itself comprises roughly about 10% of the total calls that we receive.
Okay, so I think this slide here kind of tells our story that we've been talking about. The sort of the subtrend is yes, we have had broad decreases, but as far as what this has done, we believe, and we'll show some more evidence that we've had. We've been drawn into sort of more serious incidents more often, but also that sort of resulted in us not being as proactive as we have been in past years. So on this slide, you've got our 2008 to 2017 incident mix between proactive and reactive. So OI is officer initiated, so that's the blue line. So the blue line shows you those. The officer is not being dispatched by the dispatch center, and they are able to make their traffic stop or to go deal with a community problem that we've noticed or got word of. And so they're actually out there trying to solve problems, reduce crime proactively. And we're seeing a decline in the mix, the percent. And so you see that percent starting in around 2008. It's up a little over 40% kind of on average. And then you see we're down near 30% now. In more recent years. So that's been something we've consistently talked about. So that correspondingly, these two numbers will add up to 50% or up to 100%. So in a perfect world, you know, you could start at the equilibrium to be 50-50, but our non-OI, our non-officer-initiated, which is the orange line, is increasing at a pretty steady rate. And so those are this is really like one of the key points that we're trying to get across today, is that we're not being able to be as proactive as are we, because we have more demands, needing more officers for call with these more serious situations. And this is just, again, one of the sort of sub-measures of that would be the traffic stops, which are the easiest thing to judge is how proactive we're being. And if we look since 2008 to 2016, left to right, we see that decline on the 12-month average there of traffic stops going from in the ballpark of 1,200 to down around 800 at present. Again, just a follow of that. And then psych incidents, we talked about, those are the things we're seeing actually the opposite trend, where psych incidents can indicate at least two officers dispatched. You're potentially going to be in a dangerous situation. dealing with more consistently, and you can see the numbers reflect that. And so we're more consistently dealing with these issues.
You've mentioned the drug crimes a couple of times. Your phone. Oh, not you, Chuck.
It's contagious.
lost my train of thought there for a second. The drug crimes we're talking about, are we the increases, are we seeing that in opiates, or are we seeing that in other types of drugs as well?
Well, what we're certainly seeing the increases in terms of opiates. Just in a general overview, compared to past years, meth use or meth distribution has decreased, largely because of laws put in place that limit pseudoephedrine availability. They add a chemical to ammonium nitrate, so there's you can't use it in manufactured meth. That means that meth is imported now. We don't see near as much of that as we used to see in past years. Seen very serious impact of opiate, particularly heroin importation, and as restrictions have grown on prescription drugs, it doesn't mean that people have stopped taking the drugs. It means that there's looking for alternatives, and unfortunately, heroin, which has a tendency to come in much more pure form than it has in the past, is very difficult to regulate or know what dosages are, and we've seen a number of overdoses. Typically, or in past years, people would think that that's the result of chronic heroin addiction, and we're just seeing a lot of accidental overdoses and a large number of deaths, disproportionate number of deaths occurring as a result of that. We also see marijuana trafficking, which is frankly not high on our radar for enforcement, except for the fact that there's a lot of violence associated with it. And when we've seen many of the issues that are of immediate concern, such as drive-by shootings and robberies and those kind of things, they've actually been associated with marijuana trafficking as opposed to the majority as opposed to opiate distribution and the use of drugs. So it's not, in that case, it's not the use of the drug, it's actually the trafficking. So we're trying to attack those things, as Joe said, by identifying prolific offenders, focusing our resources on those, because we know if we get the right people out in the street, we can reduce that, reduce the amount of violence in the district.
Yeah.
We have a slightly different topic of response time. This table and app shows our on the sort of north and south time here shows our police response area and our average time during the year 2016 per area. And I think geography kind of plays out as best as you could expect here with the places that are hard to get to in our area 32 and 33, which is sort of the southwest Rochester, being our slower response times. And these are just on our priority one medical calls. This is at the same time that EMS and fire are being dispatched. So, again, there probably isn't anything terribly surprising that you wouldn't expect just based on sort of the road network and the geography of things. But we have seen an overall increase, and that's reflected in the green box towards the bottom here. There's a few incidents that did geocode, so we have a slight difference in the numbers for the 2016 numbers, but we have our response times are slowly, we see a slow creep. 2017 is just a first quarter return there, so the 2016 number was higher than 2015, and 14 and 15 were similar, but we've seen this sort of drift upwards. I guess I don't really have a prediction as to what we exactly will see this year, but I think this is something that certainly is something we have to monitor. Talking about crime in specific, our this graph, this kind of gets to the population. Here we have our Part 1 crimes annual total and then per person. The blue line gives you our annual total of Part 1 crimes, and present rate, which is in the orange line. And so this sort of gives you that. So you can see the gap widening between those two things. That's something that we like to see. That means that the rate per person has been reduced. And so we see both our instant, which is a raw sort of demand measure, and we also see our sort of qualitative measure of Part 1 crimes, which are generally violent crimes, being reduced. And so we see those two things are sort of both trending in positive directions. So you're getting good outcomes. Kind of looking towards the future as far as some of the internal mechanisms that work there. But on balance, you're seeing good results here based on a reduced amount of crime per person per capita in the city. I've got some sort of tabular things.
I need to point out that contrary to the other slide you saw, this one actually goes right to left.
Yeah.
The FBI does that.
Mr. Campion?
That's why it's confusing.
So, yeah, I'm just reading it. So the key is per person. So is that's
that's one right. Time.
Okay.
It's per 1,000 people.
Okay. All right.
All it is.
All right. Perfect. I was hoping that we didn't have 30 crimes per person. Otherwise, I might have to reevaluate our method.
And really, it's a 20% reduction per capita from 2,000 to present. See, I worked in Japan. I can read right to left and left to right.
But then we just have that sort of in tabular form based on our sort of internal records. They may not mesh exactly with what the FBI has, but they're going to be in the ballpark. And as you can sort of visually see, our 2016 numbers kind of correlate with that downward trend around 25 per 1,000 capitas, not per capita. Apologize about that. We were seeing much higher numbers in the early part of the 2000s. I note that 2014 across the nation was extremely low crime. That was kind of our record year. We didn't even have, one thing we normally have each year is we have some sort of a residential burglary or some sort of burglary spree. In 2014, we didn't really have one. 2015, we had a massive one. We had over 100 commercial burglaries committed. To sort of sum up what we're dealing with, that offender's just been released. So we're back on the back in the game with.
Wait, he committed 100 burglaries in 2015, and he's been released.
109 was this year, and he was on parole for burglary at the time he was arrested by our leader. That what Joe mentioned earlier, mentioned one of the inefficiencies in the judicial system. That would be one of those.
That's such a kind way of saying.
Yeah, it's very good, I think.
Sure. I think that's, I like to point that out because when you see the 2015 numbers, the jump in burglary is really largely attributable to that one person, which is kind of supports what we're talking about with intelligence of policing. There's a really small group of bad apples. Really detecting them early on so you can get them at 15 or 20 versus 109. So, but yeah, overall, again, I said the trend is going certainly the right direction here. I think we're a really good spot, and I don't know what's the residual crime that you'd expect in a city the size of Rochester, but probably pretty close.
As part of the part of the numbers that you don't see here, as Joe was alluding to, we focus our resources on those people committing most crime, and as a result, we try to clear as many of those crimes as we can. When I say that, the statistics that are kept clear by arrest means that is that we caught and charged the person responsible for the crime. For many years, our clearance rate on the serious crimes was in the neighborhood of 30 or 31%. It kind of stayed there forever. And this last year, 2016, that was 41%. That's a pretty remarkable increase. Overall, the crimes cleared in Rochester were 55%. Include the Part 2 crimes, and that's a direct result of focusing the resources on the people that are actually committing the most crimes and therefore being able to clear more. Technology has played a big part in that. I don't know how much. Some of our investigative staff here is here. They'll be able to tell you that it's simply due to hard police work and good police work, and it is, but there's certainly a lot of factors in play there.
Thank you.
to look at?
One of the things that's come out of the some of the research done by NAACP and others is they have a concern with the analytics and basically propagating race-based policing. And I know that that's something the department's always been cognizant of here in Rochester. I'm curious what we're doing to analyze how the system's working for us.
That's, I think, as we looked at analytics as for use as a tool in terms of our response, Rochester approached this differently than the great majority of jurisdictions that are using analytics for police response. Most jurisdictions developed a geographic-based tool, that is, started with hotspots on a map to saturate your resources in those areas. What was occurring, of course, was a lot of those with a low-income, poverty-stricken neighborhoods, you put more police patrol in there in areas that were overrepresented by minority populations, and what you see as a result, a more lopsided picture in terms of policing. We didn't use that approach largely because Rochester is not an area that has a lot of hotspots. It just wasn't real conducive to that type of police response. We did focus on the people, though, and identifying people that are responsible for the most crime. In doing that, we, of course, had to develop criteria that we could demonstrate that it's race neutral. That is, we're not using race as one of the factors in that analysis, and we're not using other factors that might be associated with race. So it's not an overly complex algorithm, but generally what we're looking at is a person's criminal activity, their actual behavior, how many times they've been arrested, how many times that they've had police contact, their parole status, the type of crime that they've been involved in, as opposed to more serious crime as opposed to less serious crime. And by utilizing a number of factors, we come up with what is called our prolific offenders list. That is actually rates people by how prolific they are at any given time. And that's what we focus on. We do have to look at the impact of that. We also have to be able to determine that race or area or the other type of factors, income level and those things are not part of they're not part of the formula. And that's how we've been approaching that from the outset.
Okay. And then, I mean, it sounds like the process is sound. Do you analyze the numbers to do some checking to see if things are working the way that they're supposed to?
Well, it's difficult to, I mean, when you say the way, the way it's supposed to, I think we can certainly attest the numbers would suggest that we're hitting the right places in terms of crime reduction, and certainly looking at what impacts criminal activity in our city, how we can best attack that and be the most efficient and effective at it. It's much more difficult when you look at, if you add race in as a factor, do we have an equal representation? Absolutely not. Should we necessarily? Again, we see people that are disproportionately disadvantaged, both in terms of income, opportunity, jobs, healthcare, education, etc. Are we more likely to have contact as a result? Yes, we are. So it's not one of those problems you can look at in a vacuum and say that there should be an equal distribution there. I think what we are responsible for is making sure that we are not making enforcement decisions based on race, ethnicity, or other inappropriate reasons. At the same time, we do have to, when we are dealing with the data or the actual behavior that we're looking at, we need to be able to effectively respond to that. One of the things that we're developing or will be developing is a more objective look at things like traffic stops and things that are not driven by investigation or particular crimes, but as Joe was showing you, that officer-initiated contact as opposed to you're sent to the call or the follow-up investigation. And I think that's where we want to focus ones we don't necessarily have an option on.
And I don't know the answer to this, and I don't necessarily expect that you'll know the answer, but are there national best practices for how we're using the data analytics that we can compare our practices against?
There are. I think, if you're aware, that the previous presidential administration had developed mm-hmm. nine pillars of,
yeah.
of you know, best practice in terms of policing. Happy to say we were already engaged with most of those prior to the distribution of that. But what we focused on in terms of using analytics is to avoid the things mm-hmm. that result in disparate policing. That is, geographic-based analysis for some of the other programs. I think, you know, we've talked previously about things like facial recognition technology that has a current state of the technology that has a 20% failure rate. And the data would suggest that it is more disparate when minorities are involved. So those are things that we don't do, that we haven't engaged in. And it's not that those are blind alleys as far as future development, but until the technology actually proves itself, it's things that we can avoid or avoid producing that disparate impact while we focus on those things that we can actually see the, you know, the best results from.
And last question for me. I'm getting a lot of calls from immigrant families with mixed documentation status. There's this fear out there if they report a domestic abuse situation or something, they could potentially be, you know, become victims as a result of that. And I know that hasn't been the practice of the city of Rochester, but, you know, for those of us that are, you know, communicating with the public, and these are very real concerns, especially now, what message should we as community leaders bring to immigrant communities in terms of how we'll make sure that the greater community looks out for their safety as well?
First and foremost, we as a police department in this community, we're not engaged in immigration enforcement. Mm-hmm. Our officers don't inquire about immigration, and they don't take any action in regard to immigration. It's not an ideological issue, it's a legal one. We have no authority. Immigration is a civil issue. We've never been given any authority to enforce immigration law. There is, I think, a serious concern in regard to what future impact executive orders and statutory changes may entail. From my perspective, we are doing business the same way. We don't engage in that practice. We don't ask, and we have obviously no intention of doing so. I did meet with representatives of the ACLU mm-hmm. This past week in regard to nine different policy points in terms of ensuring that we're respecting the rights of both documented and undocumented people within our community. Very glad to say we didn't have any conflicts in regard to any of those nine points, either in terms of policy or what our past practice has been. So we're not intending to change those. I think we are all, nobody knows what that future involves in terms of legislatively where things will go, but I think we have, and I will be as clear as I can with the community. The debate around immigration really centers around illegal immigration, and when the term illegal immigrant was coined, people associate illegal with criminal, and criminal therefore dangerous. That is not the equation. As a matter of fact, I think there's plenty of research out there that will show that this is not a community that, in by percentage, is far less dangerous than our own citizens. We're not responding, and the police department, as you've seen in this presentation, is responding to what is dangerous, what presents a public safety hazard to our community. Where that doesn't exist, we're obviously not putting our resources, and
any of this stuff changes, though, you can inform the council right away that there are changes that are being put in place.
Absolutely, and as I said, we're. I think there's been a lot of news media coverage. There's been absolutely nothing that's come from any official source or channel that would suggest any change is imminent or necessary. So we're still where we were. And I certainly advise the council and mayor otherwise if that were to occur.
Mr. Campion?
I just want to say to you and all of your staff, thanks above all for your professionalism and practicality. And I've had varying degrees, everything from the drive-by that you kind of took me through as I first took office to noise complaints and other things that we've had to work through. And it's been absolute professionalism from you and your officers through and through. And I think we are probably all very, very, we have a lot of gratitude to you and the service you do, and frankly, makes our jobs a lot easier a lot of times. And I think if the numbers show what I think a lot of us feel is that our community is safe, and I think it's always good to get the reinforcement message, because in any particular instance, you get myopic and feel concerned about things that are going on, but I'm just really appreciative that you and the department seem to be looking at the trends and addressing the real crime, the actual dangerous crime. And I think that, again, that has shown to be a really valuable and a good return on investment for what we've done as a community. So kudos, and share that with the entire department.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I was told a very long time ago by a captain, kind of messaged me, that said, the secret of success is to surround yourself with good people, wait for them to do something good, and then jump in and take credit.
Absolutely.
Mr. Mayor?
Well, I would. I don't need to spend any more time on it. Nick said it extremely well. We have every reason to be very proud of our police department here, and I think the numbers are only part of it, but I can tell you, Lieutenant James Evenson went with me to India, and we said later, we don't know what we did. We weren't there selling the city in the sense of being chamber representatives, but the other people that came from around the United States that were there, towards the end, they said, they all want to come for kind of a reunion in Rochester. Two things. One, they want to visit the police department because there's something different happening here than some of them are from Jacksonville, Sacramento. The other, they said, so when we get there, we want to tour the police department and we want to go to the mayor's office. So we'll see, we'll see what happens. It was without, I mean, we just talked about what things were, how things were in Rochester and so on. It wasn't trying to, you know, blow smoke or something like that, but it was something there. And I said to Jim later, I said, it must be our Minnesota Nice that came out or something. I don't know. But again, we have every reason to be so proud. And from my own standpoint, when I, either it's the U.S. Conference of Mayors or National League of Cities or others, I always, you know, the charter says that they're the only department that reports to the mayor. That's a little different. So I always pay a special attention to that. And I always walk away from those sessions thinking again and knowing how proud I am of these guys and ladies that what they do. So, thank you.
All right. Anything else? Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the update.
Good report.
Yeah. Good news.
All right. Any other business for this afternoon,
yes.
Mr. Ruska?
Since Richard's here and Stephen, I guess I got another complaint today from blasting in the residential neighborhoods. The comment was horns, booms, people running, scattering around and not knowing who's running it and so on. So I guess I'm a little bit frustrated that we're not making any progress on this. It's been a while now and we were going to look into it and it's still happening. So just like to some feedback from them, where we're going, where we are, where we're going at it.
Okay.
With it. We're
so short.
Fieldstone.
Okay. Any comments?
I have video too if you want to see some of it from a residential house.
Mr. Reeves?
Sorry, I'm hiding back here. The fire department was the one that was working on this with their ordinance update. I'll check with them to see where it's at. I don't know where it got hung up, but I know they were including that in their their licensing through them would be required. So we needed everybody to get notice and things. So I'll
okay.
check it.
Thanks, Aaron. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Then we are adjourned. Thank you.
You just keep talking about dynamite, and I was like, I thought dynamite went out
Treehouses that are going through.
It seems like every year I'm waiting for next year for my Vikings to finally make it.
So I really need to see that. Nobody went through that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm on board.
1956 is the
bad. I'd be okay with that.
Is it 1856? I didn't know they still use dynamite.
How do I stop the recording?
Involved with the downtown.